He calls it a dark paradise. Just ahead, an expert on the history of opiate addiction in America. Good morning, and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live at 9. Also, never miss a show. Download the WJCT app. Listen to us there anytime. Stream us live now on Facebook, too. Just ahead, the nation's opioid epidemic is costing a staggering number of lives. But it's an addiction that isn't new at all. We'll learn about the long history of opiates in this country from author and professor David Courtwright in just a moment. Get on the line now at 549-2937. Then later, it's our movable feast on the show as we take a look at a growing business, Flippin' Good Cookies. Plus, a local mom determined to spread the word on her son's rare disease. We'll tell you about that, all of that ahead. But first this hour, an update on the response to this country's opioid epidemic. Recently, the Jacksonville City Council approved a $1.4 million pilot program to deal with the opiate crisis. Overdose deaths in this city and across the country are soaring. In fact, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says since 1999, overdose deaths from prescription opioids and heroin have quadrupled. Prescription opioids are a driving factor in those deaths. And none of this is news to Dr. David Courtwright, a professor of history at UNF. His book, Dark Paradise, A History of Opiate Addiction in America, was written some 35 years ago. But his research is more timely than ever as the epidemic grows and the body count piles up. Courtwright is a sought-after speaker on the topic of opiate addiction and has even addressed Congress about the issue. Speaking of Congress, of course, last night we learned that the Senate will not have the votes to repeal and replace Obamacare. Part of Obamacare that lawmakers are grappling with has to do with funds going to the states to treat opioid addiction. Now, Courtwright says we need to understand the opioid epidemic that gripped the nation more than a century ago to get a better handle on what's happening in this country right now. Dr. David Courtwright, author and professor, it's a pleasure to have you on the show. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Melissa.
And you're an expert in the history of opiates in this country. I just wanted to quickly make note of the fact that opioid treatment is a big part of the healthcare mess that Congress is grappling with as states deal with just the absolute wreckage of this epidemic around the country. This isn't new, though. This is something that you've dealt with for decades and studied for decades. And by the way, the number to join us is 549-2937. Your book, Dark Paradise, looks at the sweeping trend lines of opiates in this country going back over 100 years or more.
Right, back to the mid-19th century. And what I discovered when I first started this research was that most addiction in the 19th century was, in fact, medical. So it wasn't a matter of the majority of people being necessarily opium smokers or underworld types. It was middle-aged, middle-class women who were having various chronic conditions, and physicians were treating them with opiates, typically opium and morphine. And that got better in the early 20th century. And honestly, I thought that was the end of it. I thought I was literally writing history, and I didn't expect to see this come back again the way it did in the 1990s.
And boy, did it ever come back. Now, as you said, about a century ago, in March of 1915, lawmakers passed what was called the Harrison Act, and it cracked down on the types of narcotics that were really causing such horrible addictions, morphine, opium. It imposed tougher penalties.
Well, it put a regulatory system in place. The anti-maintenance provisions, the rules that said basically if you were an addict, you couldn't get legal supply, those came later. But you're right. In 1914, Congress passed a law which took effect in 1915, which regulated the market. But the irony is that the situation was actually getting better, at least with respect to medical addiction, prior to 1915. There had been a steady decline in the number of addicts because doctors became more circumspect in their prescribing practices. And frankly, many of the people who were addicted in the 1870s, 80s, and 90s were dying off. They were sicker people to begin with. Otherwise, they wouldn't have sought out the physicians, and they were disappearing from the scene by the early 20th century.
And so when you wrote Dark Paradise in the 80s, you thought, I'm just writing about this long-ago scourge. Then in the 90s, all of a sudden, opioids come roaring back. Why?
Well, a variety of reasons for that. First, medical addiction didn't go away. When I say that I was writing about something in the past, I wasn't naive about the fact that doctors were continuing to hand out sedatives or tranquilizers like Valium. I mean, it's not like medically related addiction disappeared, but I didn't think it would come back as opiate or opioid addiction, as we now say, because so many of these drugs are synthetics. But the key really was pressure to treat non-terminal pain. And we know now that there were certain pharmaceutical companies that actively supported groups that were lobbying for liberalized prescribing practices. And indeed, in late 1995, the FDA approved the use of OxyContin for non-terminal pain. And that's like the inflection point. That's from that point on that the number of prescriptions, the number of overdose deaths, and the number of addicts all started to rise steadily.
And if you're just tuning in, what are your thoughts about the nation's response to the opiate crisis? It's 549-2937. Give us a call as we speak with author David Courtwright. His book, Dark Paradise, looks at the history of opiate addiction in America. And so mid-90s, all of a sudden, opioids are a lot more widely available. And as you point out, it's pretty simple. The more people have access to a drug, the more addicts we're going to create.
That's right. There's this big debate right now. It's a very interesting debate, which there are some people who think that the opioid crisis is a symptom of what's wrong with America, or more particularly, what's wrong with the white American working class. There is something to that. There have been changes that do render people more susceptible to drug abuse.
You look at a town like Middletown, Ohio, not too far from where I grew up. The plant closed. All of a sudden, the whole town's hooked on opioids.
Sure, but supply is the necessary condition.
Yeah.
And if you hadn't had that increase in supply, you wouldn't have the crisis that we're in now. So my own view is that it's really primarily a problem of supply and an increasing supply, and not just of opioids, because don't forget, after the increase in opioids, the whole situation was compounded in the early 21st century by a big increase in the supply of very cheap and very pure heroin, most of which came from Mexico.
And that really sent it thermonuclear across the country, didn't it?
Yeah, there's an increase both in the number of addicts and also in the number of overdose deaths. And then there was a further complication, as we all know, in the recent past, in the last 2 or 3 years, which is the tendency of dealers to spike that black market heroin with synthetic drugs like fentanyl, which are between 50 and 100 times as powerful as morphine.
And it's the fentanyl part of this, isn't it, Dr. Courtwright, that's led to this extreme concern. The local medical examiner saying there are so many bodies piling up at the morgue due to overdose deaths from opiates, we cannot even keep up with them. Jacksonville Fire and Rescue saying they're going out on call after call after call to respond to overdoses. Is it the fentanyl lacing of this drug that you think is leading to this incredibly frightening upsurge in deaths?
Well, it's gasoline on the fire. I mean, hundreds of people were dying 3 or 4 years ago, and now it's hundreds more. It's just made a bad situation that much worse, to the point that in Jacksonville we're over 500 deaths. Last year, Fire and Rescue got over 3,400 calls. Mm-hmm. It's simply kind of a doubling down, if you will.
Now, you're an historian. Your job is to explain the history of this so we can better understand the present.
Right.
With your historical perspective, what do you think the country needs to be doing to better address this that we're not currently doing?
Well, there is good news here. One of the things that I learned is that physicians are educable. So if you actually go back and do what historians do, which is read primary sources, you read the medical journals, you read letters, you read editorials in various publications, you see that there was a lot of pressure being brought to bear on physicians and pharmacists in the late 19th and early 20th century to prescribe fewer opiates. you know, we've got a problem here. We've got to do something about it. If you are lax in your prescribing practices, you're a bad doctor and you're going to kill people. And that message got through. And then in addition to that, doctors developed new drugs or had access to new drugs, not the least of which was aspirin, for example, which mm-hmm. became commercially available in 1899, so that they could give people other more benign treatments for their aches and pains.
And do you think we need to go back to that again? I mean, we do see most physicians today more tightly controlling the prescribing of drugs like OxyContin, for example.
That's right. I think things have gotten better since 2012, 2013. I'm already seeing signs of a kind of counter-revolution. And certainly we have the emergence of organizations like Physicians for Responsible Opioid Prescribing, which are lobbying for a return to these much stricter standards.
All right. And if you're just tuning in, we're speaking with UNF historian and author Dr. David Courtwright. His book, Dark Paradise, A History of Opiate Addiction in America, is widely cited source material across the country as we grapple with the opiate epidemic in this country. What are your questions? What are your thoughts? It's 549-2937. Give us a call. Juan is in Jacksonville. Hi, Juan. Good morning.
Oh, good morning.
Yeah, go ahead.
I just wanted to mention, I'm listening to the guy that wrote this book about opioids in the turn of the century. And I'm from New York, and I grew up in the 50s and 60s. Now, I know for a fact that it was a big epidemic in New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, and all of the big cities in this country. It wasn't an epidemic then, hence the war on drugs. And nothing has been mentioned about that, because it was all in the black community. You know, take the Godfather. You know, in that movie. You know, let's keep it in the black community, and that was the thinking then. So I just wanted to make that point clear.
Yeah, you know, thanks, Juan.
Way back.
Thank you for that. And that's come up a lot as we talk about this crisis, Dr. Courtwright, that it's suddenly much more of a massive concern now that it's affecting white and middle class neighborhoods. What about that?
Well, in fact, there were federal responses to the change in drug use in the 50s and the 60s. There was very little narcotic use in this country, or street narcotic use in this country, during World War II for the simple reason that supplies had been cut off from overseas. But drugs came back in the late 40s and the early 50s, and then they really came roaring back in the late 1960s. There was a major epidemic, and the federal government responded twice. It responded in a kind of conventional way in the 50s by passing very strict federal anti-drug legislation in 51 and again in 1956. But then I think that most listeners will remember Richard Nixon's drug war mm-hmm. of the early 1970s. And that was in response to the increase in drug use, both youthful marijuana and LSD use, but also inner city heroin use, which was tied to crime. And Nixon's drug war was a little bit different. Nixon's drug war did emphasize interdiction, law enforcement, but it also provided a big increase in funding for prevention, funding for treatment, a major expansion of methadone, major expansion of so-called second-generation therapeutic communities. So the government did respond, but to Juan's point that who's addicted, who has a problem, makes a difference in what kind of governmental response you get. I do agree with that.
And what about the recent move away from treating addicts as criminals? There's been a slight shift in the way the system looks at addiction, and advocates for addicts have said that's long overdue. At the same time, just the other day, our local state attorney, Melissa Nelson, announced that she's going to seek very harsh sentences for drug dealers, even murder charges when someone overdoses.
Yeah, I saw that in the Times Union, which, by the way, has been giving very good and very extensive coverage of this issue. But there's this kind of schizoid attitude toward drug addiction and drug abuse. And people have a hard time with their feelings and with their policy views. And I will tell you also, it depends a lot on what part of the country you're in. If you're in a small town in a red state, there's one prevailing attitude toward drug use and drug addiction. And if you're in a big city like New York, which has been dealing with this for years and has routinized methadone maintenance and buprenorphine treatment and so on, you get a very different kind of attitude. So it's almost like it is woven into the culture war in exactly the same way you get different issues on questions like abortion or religious or support for religious schools in different parts of the country. You get different attitudes toward addiction, and they're very culturally and geographically specific.
All right, it's 549-2937. Rusty in Jacksonville Beach. Hey, Rusty, how are you today?
Hi, good morning. I'm doing well, thank you. I'd like to comment or take this slightly different approach on the opioid issue. We've got a great drug that has slowly been proven to be beneficial, and it's marijuana for pain management and all types of issues. And instead of criminalizing the people that are addicted to painkillers, which they obviously need it, we continue to criminalize a drug that has shown definitive medical use, yet is still classified as a number one narcotic. And federal law says we can't use it to control pain. We have to go through constitutional amendments and things of this nature to get out of this old school thought that all drugs are bad. And it seems to start at the top with our administration, regardless of who they are, with the people that they have in their control, having this old school approach to marijuana use for beneficial means and as a substitute possibly for some of the opioids. Prescription.
Okay, yeah. Thanks, Rusty, for that. Okay, what about that? Now, it's my understanding, David Courtright, that you were not in favor of marijuana legalization, but what about Rusty's point that particularly for pain patients, cancer patients, cannabis has been an alternative that's less dangerous, less addictive?
Well, I do think marijuana has potential as a medication that has not been fully explored. And I would certainly agree that if you could get away with treating your knee pain with an occasional toke of a joint as opposed to taking 40 or 80 milligrams of OxyContin, you'd be better off. I don't think there's any question about that. On the other hand, I would point out that self-medication with marijuana is not exactly risk-free either, mm-hmm. that there are possibilities of dependence in a certain percentage of cases. The big advantage actually of marijuana is that the risk of fatal overdose is far, far less. That's the tremendous difference, I think, between the two drugs.
So you were in favor then of Florida legalizing it for medical use?
I was ambivalent because what I know from talking to people in the quote-unquote cannabis industry, from attending conferences and reading the literature that comes out of this industry, is that it's not just about medicalization. Medicalization is widely seen as a first step toward a full-blown legal market. The danger that I see is that cannabis will one day become like big alcohol or big tobacco. I think if it's a small-scale regulated industry that does help people with certain medical conditions, fine. Who could object to that? I do not think that that is the goal of many of the entrepreneurs who are associated with this nascent industry. I think they have much bigger plans. And
much bigger dollar signs in their eyes, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. And much bigger lobbying power, you name it. And that's the question. Let me make an historical point. There's a big difference between a drug being legal and available by prescription, which is one thing, and a drug being commercialized. And once the drug becomes commercialized, and
that's what we saw with OxyContin, right? People made a lot of money off OxyContin. Somebody made money.
Absolutely right, and you're still seeing it for example, advertisements for opioid related constipation. That's an aspect of what historians call normalization. Once people start thinking, oh, this is just another normal commercial product, the likelihood of use will increase, and a certain percentage of people who use it are going to develop problems with it, period, full stop. That's the way it is. So what you want to do is try to create a regulated market where the people who really need it get it, but that it doesn't become something like soap or Cracker Jacks on the aisle of a supermarket.
That's been the sticky wicket of this, because as they try to crack down on abuse, the people that do need it have had a hard time getting it. It's hard to thread that needle, isn't it?
Well, that's right, but it's not just for cannabis. I mean, if you think about it, they're all...
And I was referring to opiates.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And
cannabis.
And cannabis and any number of other drugs. I mean, the federal government in 1970 created a law, the Controlled Substances Act, which essentially created categories of regulation for different drugs, which govern things like how frequently you can get a refill and whether you can do it by phone and so on. And that's really, I think, the best way to go about this. You have to make a realistic assessment of what are the dangers and benefits of a substance, and then create an appropriate regulatory system for prescription control.
All right, 549-2937 to join us. We'll go to your tweets in a moment, but right now let's go to Robert in Mandarin. Hey, Robert, thanks for holding. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Melissa.
Sure.
And Mr. Courtwright. My two questions are, and you're addressing, what is the role of big pharmaceuticals, you know, historically within the opioid epidemic? And I tend to be a realist, and with a global economy, that we have and really open borders when it comes to trade, with regard to supply and demand, if there's always going to be a need from the person who's suffering from addiction, then are many measures going to be pointless? Will there always be a problem? Will somebody always find their drug? And I can take my answer offline.
Yeah, thanks, Robert.
Robert, those are both very good questions. Purdue Pharma and other pharmaceutical companies, who, by the way, are now being sued, did actively promote the use of their products, prescription opioids, for the treatment of non-terminal pain. There's no question about that. As to the second question, interdiction does make a difference, but there's a trade-off. If you attempt to restrict the flow of an addictive drug into the country, you're going to have black market consequences. There's no question about that. However, you're also going to make the price of the product higher, availability more difficult, and so you will have some effect. So almost anyone in the field would tell you that when you have prohibition, you end up with fewer users, but each one of those fewer users has more problems and generates more social costs. So that's the...
Just ask Ken Burns, right?
Yeah, so that's...
that film was pretty fascinating on prohibition.
Actually, alcohol prohibition is a great example. Cirrhosis deaths dropped in the early 1920s. The price of beer in most American cities increased between 5 and 10-fold. People drank less. But at the same time, you know, we all know about Al Capone and the rise of gangsterism and disrespect for the law and speakeasies. So it's pick your poison. I mean, do you want more users who have fewer problems and who generate fewer social costs, or do you want fewer users and the inevitable problems of a black market scenario?
Brian tweets the show, David Courtwright raises a scary scenario. Like other aspects of agriculture, mega corporations will squeeze out small farms. Here's another tweet. Please mention how the elderly are used as pill mills where the addicts steal their meds. What about that?
I assume that the first question is in reference to small marijuana cultivators.
Yes, I would
just on the basis of what happens to all psychoactive product industries, ultimately you're going to move toward oligopoly, and then, as in the case of alcohol and tobacco, I think duopoly. I mean, there are a couple of large corporations globally that dominate both alcohol and tobacco. I would expect something similar would happen over a period of time with cannabis. Let's see, the second question again, second tweet.
About how the elderly are used as pill mills by addicts who steal their medication.
Yeah, that's That's been a problem from the beginning. And the word that's used in the literature is diversion. So one of the big problems is, what if, and remember, not everybody who takes pain medication is an addict or is causing problems. But let's suppose that someone does have a regular supply of a pain medication. It's sitting in the medicine cabinet, and their niece or nephew is visiting, and they steal a few pills. All right, and that kind of diversion might get somebody going. Originally, you could take a pill like OxyContin, and you could crush it, and you could sniff it. You could get high. It's a very powerful high. We know from the case studies that the way that some people got into addiction in the late 90s, early 2000s was through diverted medications. And that's another thing we need to do. Not only do we need to be, I think, more circumspect in prescribing, but we need to be more careful about how much we prescribe and for what period of time. So that, for example, recently there was a study showing that addicts, or rather patients who received drugs for and took drugs for more than 5 days were more likely to become addicted. If they got a 30-day supply, they were really much more likely to become addicted. If they got refills, especially for long-acting opioids, that was a risk factor. And then finally, on top of all of that, there's another possibility, which is if they've got these things sitting around, they're going to be ripped off or otherwise diverted.
One more call. Let's go to Pam. Pam in St. Augustine. Hi, Pam.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I think it's time for Northeast Florida, Jacksonville, and St. Augustine to make simple possession of marijuana a civil ordinance punishable by a $100 fine. If it's the second time, a $200 fine. But the reason for that is numerous. It's about court costs for the city and the county, and which you're never totally repaid. And it would save court congestion, so that's a big deal. And it would make money for the city and the county. But most of all, for the families, I know in St. Augustine, 19,000 families make less than $30,000 a year. They don't have money to pay, you know, $500 to $1,000 in court costs and lawyers. And also, the young people don't need that stipulation. They don't need to be ostracized, and they don't need to be thrown into the hands of drug dealers that are more dangerous. Also, marijuana's never killed anybody. Tobacco and alcohol have been legal for years. They kill.
All right, yeah. Thank you, Pam. And almost more interest in talking about marijuana this morning than opiates, but David Courtwright, your final thoughts, particularly since we're waiting to see how Congress deals with how we're going to fund opioid addiction treatment in this country. That's in flux right now. We don't know how the fate of the Affordable Care Act and what it may be replaced with.
Well, I guess long-term I'm an optimist on this issue. I mean, epidemics don't go on building forever, and eventually you get a decline in prevalence for good and for bad reasons. Addiction is a condition. It's like being on a highway with lots of off-ramps. And some of those off-ramps are pretty abrupt and terrifying. I mean, there are ways to exit the addict population suddenly and for good that aren't very pleasant. On the other hand, we do know from the literature that many people mature out of addiction. It's a myth that you're necessarily going to be an addict for the rest of your life. But it may take several tries. And in that respect, it's a lot like cigarette smoking. So a typical person who quits smoking cigarettes takes 6 or 7 tries before they finally quit for good. Okay, and that's pretty much what happens with drug treatment. It takes multiple trials. So we need to make sure that people have those opportunities, even if we have to be patient and recognize you're not going to succeed necessarily on the first time. But we also have to be acutely aware that what's unique about opiates is that when you come out of treatment, and if you fail and relapse, that is the moment of maximum vulnerability when you are most likely, if you take another dose, to overdose and die.
That's right. And we're certainly seeing a lot of that right now. So your insights are so valuable. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Melissa, you're welcome.
He is author and historian David Courtwright of UNF. His book is Dark Paradise, A History of Opiate Addiction in America. Much more still ahead later, helping the visually impaired break the stigma of their condition. We'll speak with the head of Moms for Sight. But up next, it's Movable Feast, and we're going to the cookie store. Back in a moment.
Next time on 1A, the healthcare hiatus. The Senate healthcare bill is on hold and time is running out. The days ahead could be pivotal in the history of American social policy. Is this week's timeout good or bad for the bill's supporters? And what happens now? Next time on 1A. Weekdays at 10 after First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Join us for more True Stories Told Live. This time, traditional Jewish weddings, studies in the Congo, and confronting hecklers.
A man got up in the middle of my show and actually yelled, "Go back to America!" Because I've been told to go back to so many countries, never to America.
That's on the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Saturdays at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
I'm Christian McBride, and this week on Jazz Night in America, it's the music of the genius, Ray Charles, played by the men and women who hit the road with him throughout his career, including
Ray Less
with Diane Shore,
also known as Deedles.
It's a family reunion at Jazz Lincoln Center in the name of Ray. Check it out this week on Jazz Night in America.
Saturdays at 8 p.m. and Thursdays at 11 p.m. on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Support for Movable Feast is made possible by 927 Events, event venue and catering.
Welcome back. Well, they are one delicious treat and a rapidly growing business here on the First Coast. What makes them so flippin' good? Well, in today's Movable Feast, Lee Court of the Women's Food Alliance finds out as she talks to Janice Newton, owner of Flippin' Good Cookies.
Have a banana, Hannah. Try the salami, Tommy. Give it to gravy, Davy. Everybody eats when they come to my house. Try a tomato plate.
Our guest today is Janice Newton, who has an amazing company that appealed to me a few years ago just by hearing the name Flippin' Good Cookies. And I said, I need to know you. So welcome, Janice.
Thank you, Lee. It's great being in here.
And it's really fun to talk about the Flippin' Good Cookies, which I've gotten to know personally over the past few years, from parties that I've personally had to Women's Food Alliance parties and themed cookies that you create that are just really unique. Firstly, they're amazingly delicious because they're shortbread.
That's right.
Tell me about shortbread and how you created Flippin' Good Cookies.
Well, first of all, we've been in business for 9 years now, and we started off with traditional cookies. And then we started getting requests for more specialized cookies. And I've always loved shortbread. And I had baked shortbread in the past. So I said, why not combine the shortbread and make them fun and decorate them? So we went ahead and started with an all-butter vanilla shortbread. It's a very simple recipe, but it's absolutely delicious. And it attracts everyone because the flavor is just that beautiful buttery vanilla. And we do a lot of decorating with them, including corporate. We also help people with their life celebrations, such as birthdays, weddings, baby showers, and so on.
And other more even creative. I remember having a party, and it was all about music, and you created grand pianos on my shortbread Flippin' Good Cookie.
Yes, we get a lot of our inspiration actually from our customers, and then we just run with it. That's what makes it so much fun. And just seeing the looks on people's faces when they come by and pick up their orders, they're always pleased. And that's our whole thing. We want them to taste wonderful, look wonderful, as if we were making them for ourselves, and we want to be happy with it. If we're happy with it, then we know people are going to be happy with the end product.
For people who are not bakers, let's start with the basic of shortbread. I think shortbread has a very simple recipe, but it's all about the balance of it. Tell me about shortbread.
Absolutely. It is basic, but it's also in the baking. It takes a while. They should call them long breads because they do take a while to bake. They take almost an hour. And that gives them their nice, crispy, but very gentle crunch. It's not a hard crunch. It's a very subtle, crispy cookie. And we use royal icing for the decorating.
Oh, the royal icing. That's
yes.
How you put the top on the custom cookies.
That's
and make
correct.
All these amazing images.
Yes. And then when we do logo cookies, we use edible icing sheets. And we use the royal icing as the glue. And so the whole cookie is 100% edible because people will ask, can you eat these? And it's always, of course, yes. Everything we bake is edible.
Actually, when I have visited your website, flippinggoodcookies.com, I've actually seen cookies with people's images on them. And I can imagine that they're celebrating something special and they almost don't want to eat the picture.
That happens
a lot.
Yes, yes. A lot of times people say they don't want to eat the cookie because of the photo of their baby or something like that. So I said, please just eat them.
Well, I'm going to tell you a secret because every time I've personally had Flippin' Good Cookies, I have not wanted to eat all of them. I like to save them like for mementos from my parties or celebrations. And they're all individually wrapped in these little clear plastic cellophane bags, and they're beautiful, so they're gifted. But I've had some in my kitchen for a long time, and when I open them, they taste just as fabulous as when I bought them.
Well, that's really good to know.
Really?
Because that's a big question we get, is the shelf life. I like to say a week, but some people say it can be months. And but I stick with the week because we just like the quality control, and we want to make sure that whatever goes out stays fresh.
Well, one of the funnest parts for me is that I love to send gifts to people in other places.
Absolutely.
And I have sent a lot of Flippin' Good Cookies to other people in New Jersey and Florida. And in fact, I sent something to my grandson who loves Legos, and you created the most amazing Lego cookie that looked like they interwove with each other. I mean, they were just adorable.
Those were a lot of fun to make. We love doing that. it, like I said, it's like it can be any celebration from getting married, and also it can be more sad situations that are bittersweet. People. Yeah. We just had a lady call, and she has a dear friend in hospice, and she's celebrating a 60th birthday, and we're doing some fancy high heel shoes for her birthday.
That
just makes it special
fabulous.
For us. We love being a part of that.
Well, I wish our listeners could be with us in the studio today because I'm looking at the cutest summer cookie, which is a red, white, and blue flip-flop. So it's not only the summer, but it must be July 4th.
That's exactly right.
Cookie.
4th of July. We love to take a holiday theme and just sort of mix it up with another shape, just like the flip-flop, and we just did the red, white, and blue to make it patriotic and all-American. So the all-American flip-flop cookie.
So you are in business with your husband, correct?
That's correct.
And do you have a creative bakery somewhere and a retail location? Tell our listeners how
sure.
they can have their own Flippin' Good Cookies.
That's correct, yes. I am in business with, and my partner is my husband, Mike. And you have to have a good sense of humor and a strong relationship to be in business with your husband, but it works. And we do have a storefront now. We've been doing this again for 9 years.
Congratulations.
Thank
Great.
You. We've been doing this for 9 years now, and we were in a commercial kitchen, and then we took over the kitchen and renovated it, and now we have a storefront where we bake cookies daily.
And where is that in Jacksonville?
It's 3611 St. John's Bluff Road South, not too far from the St. Johnstown Center area.
So people can come in, they
yes.
can see samples, they can actually buy
yes.
whatever seasonally prepared for the specialty cookies,
mm-hmm.
but also your traditionals. I'm looking at a giant traditional cookie. What am I tasting right over here?
That is an oatmeal almond brickle. That's one of our
oh my gosh.
That's one of our favorites there.
Oatmeal almond brickle. So this is your traditionals. What are some of the traditionals that you began with before you started doing the specialty?
Well, funny
cookies?
Enough, we started with three flavors. It was a Ghirardelli chocolate chip, the oatmeal almond brickle, and then a pecan caramel. And now we've expanded to several other flavors. Yummy. Along with the decorated cookies.
So if you had to say what your original signature cookie was that launched Flippin' Good Cookies, which is the one that you pay homage to?
Well, it has to be the chocolate chip.
Chocolate, the chocolate chip cookies, yes. With your deli chocolate.
Made with a lot of love.
Well, I am just so glad that you joined me today. I love your cookies. I can't wait to plan another theme. I'm big on Academy Awards, and I know that you did this amazing gold cookie. I can't even imagine eating the little award on top. Before we say goodbye,
sure.
Can you describe in words the way that you created the look of this? It almost looks like a deco cookie, an art deco style with the Academy Award inside and like little gold flecks around the outside.
Sure. Well, of course, it starts with the shortbread cookie, and then we find images, and then the ones that we feel would look the best, we go ahead and print those out on the edible image sheets, and then we add borders, and this one had a gold glittery sparkly border.
It is beautiful, and I can't wait to plan another party. So excuse me while I grab a cup of coffee, and I'm going to eat a red, white, and blue flip-flop cookie today. Thank you, Flippin' Good Cookies, and Janice. It was
Thank
great
you.
Having you here.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed it.
Everybody eats when they come to my
Yummy. And we'll be right back.
Hey there, I'm Joshua Johnson, the host of 1A, and I am coming to WJCT Studios for a free listening party for younger public radio listeners. They'll be featuring a Skype Q&A with me, thought-provoking conversation, and refreshments, of course. The event is on Tuesday, July 25th from 6 to 8 p.m. Registration is free, but you do have to sign up. You'll find more online at wjct.org/events.
Sponsored in part by Firehouse Subs.
Next time on Radiolab.
What is there in human nature that allows an individual to act inhumanely, harshly, severely?
Why did you do this? Why did you inflict all this suffering on them, on us? Why?
It was not my personal affair. I had to do what I was ordered.
Does everybody at some point have something dark in them that just tiptoes out, just from time to time?
Saturdays at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
Convinced you've heard it all before? Well, at Indie Endeavor, we challenge that notion. Tune into WJCT's After Hours for the best songs you've never listened to. Tuesdays at 11 p.m.
Welcome back. Finally this hour, she's the proud mom of an 18-year-old son who lives with a condition known as XLRS. It's a rare disease and few of us have heard of it. But this mom has made it her life's mission to educate the public and also help visually impaired people become fully contributing citizens. She founded her own organization with that whole goal in mind. Moms for Sight Executive Director Lisa Pleasance is here with more. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. And you've become a national crusader when it comes to raising awareness and treatment for retinal degenerative diseases.
Correct. There are about 10 million people in the country with these retinal degenerative diseases.
And one of them is your son.
Correct.
And I had not heard of this until you approached us, but he has a condition called XLRS. What is that?
Right. That's X-linked juvenile retinoschisis. And it, he's legally blind. And he's been legally blind since he was born. A lot of folks who get this disease start off with pretty normal vision, and then it gets worse over time. And he mm-hmm. still has the opportunity, or not the opportunity, the chance for it to get worse over time. So it could get even worse. Right now, he can see, if you look at the eye chart, he can see the big E and what's right below the big E.
Okay, so some vision, but it's declining.
Right.
What causes it?
It's genetic. So I have two brothers that also have the disease and a cousin. Mm-hmm. It's carried by the females in the family, and males are the ones who have the symptoms.
And what's it been like for you as his mom, raising a son with this issue?
It's been difficult. The worst day probably of my life was the day that we found out he had it. He had a 50-50 chance of getting it,
uh-huh.
and he got it. And over time, through school, we've had to work with teachers in the schools to make sure he has large print so he can read the books that everybody else is reading, and magnifiers and tools that he's had in classes. He's had he's had giant monitors on his desk with cameras on him that can focus on the chalkboard, so it comes on the monitor in front of him. So he's had a lot of technology that's helped him over the years.
Now, over the years, too, you've been like other rare disease advocates, raising awareness, but also trying to find clinical trials, trying to find help. What's the status of that?
Absolutely. Right now, there is actually a clinical trial going on for X-linked juvenile retinoschisis in a few in Boston, Oregon, and Texas and Michigan. Mm-hmm. And we've actually, my son Brendan participated in the historical clinical trial in Oregon. So we had to go out there 4 times, which was really kind of fun too. And then he started to participate in the actual gene therapy trial that's going on right now in Boston. Unfortunately, that hasn't worked out the way we wanted it to. But
what about the other clinical trial? Is there hope there?
There is absolutely hope for not just his disease, but a lot of other rare retinal degenerative diseases like retinitis pigmentosa, achromatopsia, that I could name probably 20 different diseases.
Yeah. You know, we have a personal connection to this here at WJCT. Our own Michelle Corum runs our radio reading service, and that is a service we provide for people with low to no vision.
Right.
And we have volunteers every day who come in here and they employ a special radio studio and a special radio channel to read the Times Union and other publications for people at home who have a special shortwave radio so that they can hear, you know, they can keep up with the news and what's going on in the world if they can't read the publications.
That's an awesome service.
It is. And it sensitized me and all of us to the issues of people that have, that are visually impaired, because it's your goal with Moms for Sight to help visually impaired people become fully contributing members of society, right?
Absolutely. I have two brothers with the disease, and one is also legally blind like my son, and he's an engineer. My son wants to be an engineer, and there should be nothing that holds him back from that. There are so many tools today, especially with the technology out there, that people who are visually impaired should be able to do the same thing that fully sighted people can do.
How does Moms for Sight work to make that happen?
We have a website, momsforsight.org, where people can go who are interested to learn more. And we, over the years, I've gotten to know so many moms across the country who have children with these diseases. And for the most part, there are a lot of questions people have. So I've had this experience for 18 years. A lot of people who are new moms or just finding out really need someone to reach out to, and they can call me and we can talk through it, and I can help them with the school questions and all kinds of things.
Yeah, it's not a club anyone wants to be
no,
in. But there's support out there.
Exactly.
When you talk about any rare disease, that is really the trajectory of it, isn't it? I mean, no mom or dad wants this to happen to their child. And it's so important to find a network of other families that can provide that support and that information.
Absolutely. And here in Jacksonville, there's a Jacksonville chapter of the Foundation Fighting Blindness. And that's for people with rare retinal degenerative diseases. It's so hard to say that.
Uh-huh.
And so we've gotten to all know each other here. And that's how we all started. And then because we wanted to raise more money for that, it was really hard to raise money. It takes money to raise money. So we were coming out of our own pockets, which is why we developed Moms for Sight.
Now, you've had your big event already from the last quarter, but you've got another one coming up in the spring.
Right. We have an event every year called Black Ties and Blindfolds, and that's our main fundraiser. And that money goes directly to research for these clinical trials.
And it's momsforsight.org. Check it out. And check out our radio reading service, too, at wjct.org. She's Moms for Sight Executive Director Lisa Pleasance. And thanks for sharing your story.
Thank you for having me.
That's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Merchart. Michelle Corum runs the board. The show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. Never miss a show. Download the WJCT app. Listen to us there anytime. Or the podcast is also up every day on iTunes. Next on 1A, who will decide healthcare's future? I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.